welcome to another episode of the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. I'm Jessica Dahlquist, your host, and every Tuesday I interview a different mom who shares their motherhood journey and the lessons they've learned along the way. If I've learned anything from interviewing such a wide range of moms, it's that no two extraordinary moms look the same. We all have a story to tell, and we are all mothering in our own way. So let's celebrate that and learn from one another. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you hear, please share the show with a friend. Today we're covering a new topic on the podcast, and that is the topic of addiction. Today I'm speaking with Annie Highwater, who recently wrote a book called Unhooked that details her son's drug addiction and their journey to getting him healthy and sober again. It is a very vulnerable story where she talks about her single parenting of her son and developing that bond. It seemed like he had everything going for him, and then addiction took over, and it really just wrecked their life for a time. And now she wants to share that message so that she can help other parents who may be experiencing the same things or make parents more aware of the warning signs before getting to that point. She's a great author. I'm so proud of her for being bold and sharing this really difficult story, and I know that you're going to love getting to know her journey today. So let's get to it with Annie. All right. I want to welcome Annie Highwater. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. Where am I speaking to you from today?
Columbus, Ohio.
Awesome. Is it freezing there?
It's chilly. It's okay. Not freezing. It's up and down. Our weather's kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome. We lived in Michigan for a time, so you're lucky to be on the podcast with your Columbus affiliation.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. We just had the big game.
Exactly. That was a rough one.
Right.
Well, I'm really honored to be talking to you today, and I'm really proud of you for sharing this really vulnerable story, and you wrote this amazing book called Unhooked. And I just loved it, Annie. I think you did such a great job telling your story.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. So why don't you give our listeners a little background on yourself and your family so we can get to know you a little better.
Okay. So the background, a lot of that is detailed in the book too. And I tried to keep it brief and just give some examples without going on and on and on. But it's kind of, I call it that I was born into folie à deux, if you're familiar with that French term, which it's a psychology term that means the madness of many. And I definitely don't mean that insulting. We were just, my family had a lot of problems and a lot of dysfunction to overcome, and I was born right into the middle of it. So being the youngest of six, my parents' house, I believe, had just burned down when my mom was about 8 months pregnant with me. So I'm baby six. They moved in with her parents. There was a lot of conflict, and they didn't move out of there for a year, so I was kind of kept in a crib and didn't walk until the day they moved out, so I was kind of neglected, which it's, I guess it's understandable with all of the hardships they had going on and things they were dealing with. So that was my start. It was kind of a rough start. I was not communicated with really well. I didn't understand that there had been prior drinking issues in my family. My father had gotten sober before I was born, and that is what you would call, I guess, a dry drunk, which is somebody who has problems coping or whatever, but they're no longer drinking. So I was born into smack dab into all of that, and everyone had dealt with that in my family, and I really didn't have a clue what all of this misery was. So those early years, nobody really communicated with me. The neglect continued on from the baby years to all the way up through elementary. My mom had struggled. She'd had some nervous issues and anxieties and probably mental issues, and then she had gotten dependent on prescription pills several times and a final time on painkillers when I was in middle school. But leading up to that, I wasn't really well taken care of. I was sent to different schools and not told I was even changing schools, and I was sent not clean, and I didn't see a dentist and things like that. And then I would be sent into these settings and kind of just had to cope on my own as a child. So that was what the beginning was.
Wow. That's a beginning. Yeah. That's a beginning for you. How would you say that upbringing, like, how did you view your future? Like, were you really hopeful that you could kind of break out of that mold, or did you kind of see your life continuing on in that type of way?
I guess I really thought I was at fault for it. And my father always stuck my nose in books, so I developed this thirst for literature and reading, and I went into nonfiction and biographies and self-help and all that, and I kind of found my way up and out and through at the library. So I really hadn't thought about it until I got a little bit older and realized I didn't want to spend my life in that kind of pathology or that misery, even if it was my fault. I didn't express it too much or reveal too much. I've even had people contact me now who said, I really had no idea your home life was like that. We went to school together, and I thought you were either standoffish, or maybe you had it all together, or maybe you didn't like me, or maybe you were just mad, or maybe you were just fun. Whatever your experience with me was, I didn't really express that I was going home to this misery too much. Mm. So I was just kind of trying to find my way through in the dark, and sometimes I would ask the librarian about things that were going on at home and change the story around a little bit just because I was trying to find normal.
Wow.
I think kind of intuitively, you know, as a young child, you're a clean slate as far as information goes. You're trying to find normal. And what's taught to you as normal at home, and then you start seeing differences in other homes or school kids or whatever, you're just trying to find normal. And I do want to say as a side note, I wasn't physically abused. I wasn't sexually abused or anything like that. I know I could have had it worse. I just felt like my upbringing, I was pretty miserable within it.
Right.
But I definitely could have had it worse.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. But that's still a hard way to start out. And it's a hard thing to break out from if that is your normal. It's hard to view a life where you could have more than that and you could be treated better than that and you could expect more of that, you know? We only know what is around us, you know?
Right.
So it's amazing that you've kind of moved beyond that. So tell me about having your son.
Well, I had him as I was finishing high school, and he was not expected, or he was a surprise, I should say, and it just sent me into even more panic about my circumstances. I had listened to this interview once with the author Beth Moore, where she had said her background had been so crazy, and when she had one of her daughters, she read a story in a book by Gilda Radner where a dog had backed into a lawnmower and it was pregnant. And the dog got saved and all the puppies were saved, but the dog had no back legs. And she taught herself to drag herself on her front legs. So when the puppies learned to walk, they all walked just dragging themselves on the front legs. And she interpreted that as this child's going to walk like I walk. So that really stuck with me too, because your child's going to walk like you walk. So I went into this fear of, oh my goodness, I don't want him to feel neglected or not clean or poor or different or worthless or any type of dysfunction. So I was in this desperate search. I would have his baby carrier beside me in the library reading biographies and checking out self-help books and trying to pick up practices of other families and people and to learn how to not mess this kid up. So that was his start.
Right. Did you feel more stressed out by that obligation, or were you kind of motivated when you had him?
I would say both, just because I have this really passionate love for him right away.
Right.
Even though he wasn't expected. It was like, oh my goodness, I just love him with everything that is me. So it was motivation as well as a desperation to fight against the grain of what I'd been brought up in.
Wow. And sometimes you have to have that to light the fire under you, right? It doesn't always have to be just this altruistic, like, I just want to be the best mom ever. Like, sometimes there has to be that scrappiness inside of you to, like, get up every morning if you're not feeling it, right? And that's true for any mom. And
absolutely.
So was his dad in the picture early on?
Yes, he was always. And we were together about 9 years, and then we split. And then, the first 2 years after we split up, we were pretty broken. And I would say conflicting and dysfunctional, and I don't know if you have experienced or you know anyone that has. The first couple of years, you're kind of like, hey, you forgot our son's backpack. Well, you're this, and you go into these, your conflict issues.
Yeah.
So the first couple of years, we definitely had that. But both of us had come from situations where we felt disappointed by it. So we didn't want to give him that. So we had ended up meeting together and having this 4-hour conversation of let's get it all out and move on. And we really never held anything against each other after that.
Mm-hmm.
And we developed this really fun, jovial, peaceful, shared parenting where he remarried and my son has brothers. And we all sat at games together. And sometimes we would do holidays, never separate birthdays. And we really worked hard to make that work.
Do you have any tips for anybody that might be co-parenting right now where maybe it's not as amicable? How did you go about making that as peaceful as possible?
I guess it comes down to your motive.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't motive to war.
Yeah.
So it wasn't an issue of I'm going to one-up you or I'm going to rat you out to this child to make you look bad so that I can be the hero parent. Wow. And we're not going to split the atmosphere to where you're better off here and then I'm arguing over there. If a punishment stuck at his dad's house, it was the same under my roof. And we just didn't battle. I didn't have a need to pounce on everything he did. and he didn't have a need to continue conflict beyond solving a problem. And really, when you're about the, you know, well-being of a child and you truly are for peace, you're not gunning and driven for those situations. Yeah. So that's pretty much how I say you can make a divorce situation work. Try to keep the kids out of conflict and try not to constantly have conflict.
Right, because I think the tendency might be for children to blame themselves anyway. And so for you to kind of be manipulative or put things on them and make them feel in the middle, like they're going to read between the lines on that and feel even more, you know, at that. So it's not their fault. And I think that approach is probably the most healthy and consistency for any child.
It works so well. And these years are going to pass, and I want them to pass as peacefully as possible. So I'm not going to manipulate or talk about them or their flaws or shortcomings and then send you to their home to where that burden's on you. Like, yeah, those things are all unnecessary, and in my opinion, I think they're gross.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it just perpetuates the contention. The longer that you want to keep it going, it can keep going that way. But as soon as you choose...
Yeah, and for years. Yeah. I've seen it go on for years.
Yes, absolutely. And so would you say, growing up, that you had a great bond with your son and that you were close to him and kind of in the know in his life?
I would. I would say I kind of took this us against the world mentality. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want him to be a mama's boy, or, you know, I tried very hard to have balance, so that even though I was protective and tried to ingrain certain things into his character, I'm not going to make you so dependent on me that you can't go face life and cope.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, try to fight every one of your battles and be over dramatic. You know, they say if a child falls, your reaction is how they will cope.
Right.
You know, definitely you have to check and see if they're hurt. But if you're saying, oh my goodness, are you okay? And you make a huge deal out of it, then they're going to turn on the waterworks even more. So I just really tried hard to make him tough as much as I hovered over everything.
Yeah.
So we went through a period where my father died, and we experienced a lot of death during this span of time, and I had to explain those things to him because he was affected. So I decided I would run a marathon during the midst of that and take him with me. And that was just kind of how we lived our life when he was growing up. We faced things. We faced them as positively as possible. You do the research, you find the strength, and you get up and go. And that's really what his entire childhood was: trial and error and fall and get up.
Right. Have you read the book Rising Strong by Brené Brown?
I love it. Yes.
Well, so much of what you're saying is reminding me. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's about really wrestling with those emotions and getting real with your past, getting real with how you feel about things and maybe what has been previously ingrained in you, but having the strength to be able to move forward past that and create whatever life it is and feel however it is that you want to feel going forward. And I think that's really what you've adopted in your life, which is really admirable.
Right. Well, my father taught me those types of things. He was kind of a self-help walking guru or walking book. That's what he was always going from one to the next and trying to latch on to something that brought him up and forward. So I kind of took that torch from him and face life, face hardships, definitely be real. And sometimes I have to sit down and say, I'm not going to smile through this misery today. I'm just going to sit with it. But then I'm going to get up, and what can I do about it? I'm not going to dwell in it or blame anybody for it or feel sorry for myself and say, this is why I didn't proceed into this or that goal, or I developed a crappy personality because I can blame this or that. You get down into the midst of your misery, deal with it, face it, and heal forward.
Yeah, I like that. I love that. So when did you start to notice a change with your son?
Well, you know, they kind of start changing when they're 13 or 14, and their friends become more and more important, and you become less intelligent, and they desire to be around you a little bit less. So those things are pretty well normal. And I'd always kept kind of a therapist on call. So I would call friends of mine who worked in that industry, and I would say, what is this? And I'd learned of a term called individuating, which when kids hit their teen years, they start kind of pulling away and testing boundaries and really, really testing boundaries because they're preparing to go off and cope on their own. So it becomes a time of sort of conflict, and our relationship developed a little bit of a percussion with that, but it was not abnormal. And he'd tried a little thing, some ornery things to go out and hang around, even some of the party kids, but we reined that in really quick and were really fierce with consequences. So nothing out of the normal that we couldn't deal with consequences, communication, and boundaries until he'd had an injury in football and quickly developed a dependency upon narcotics that were prescribed.
Now, would you say that he had any, like, predisposition to, like, would you have predicted that this could ever be your son?
Well, my mom had dealt with those issues.
Okay.
Because she had been given prescriptions. So mm-hmm. I knew enough to know it was possible, but I believed, because I knew I had experienced it, and I had tried to take every step possible, you know, getting along with his dad and not having an atmosphere of conflict and chaos, and trying to take all the necessary protection to keep him from it. I thought I could prevent it.
Right.
Even I had him in a Christian school, and I had him in church 3 nights a week. We didn't have R-rated television. He wasn't allowed to play with guns. I mean, I was over the top careful about everything without, you know, creating a kid who couldn't face life. So I thought, with my knowledge and experience to a degree, I was going to prevent it until the injury came. I'd even tried to ask the doctor not to prescribe him anything that would be something he could become dependent on. But the doctor let me know I was not the doctor, mm-hmm. and it was what was needed.
Right.
So I could have predicted it, but I thought I was preventing it.
And I think that's what's so hard as a parent. Like, you feel like you're doing your very best job to set your children up for success and to avoid those pitfalls and avoid those mistakes and everything. But ultimately, they're their own person, and they're going to make their own choices, regardless of if they go to church, regardless of if they're on a sports team, regardless of if they have good friends. They're still going to make their own choices. And so I think that's why, even if the listeners haven't necessarily dealt with something like this, or maybe they think, oh, this doesn't apply to me, I'm not in this category, nobody's immune to any type of challenge, including this, that you would have never predicted yourself. And so I think that's why it's important to hear these types of stories, because it's when we're not aware of the potential for these things, it's that we get caught off guard and we truly don't know what to do. And that's when you really get in trouble, right?
That's when the blind side comes. And
yes.
In fact, I would have dinner with one of his teachers at the Christian school he went to about monthly, because I just really like to pick the brain of people who are normal or, you know, educated in a different area than I am, or in the mental health industry. And I remember telling her I wanted to be aware, as he went into his teen years, of what could potentially happen, since I remember somebody telling me, you're not going to have 5 minutes of rebellion with this kid. He is the most well-mannered. He's like letting a puppy loose in a room. He is friendly to everybody. He will take your trash cans to the curb, and he will do anything for anyone. He's the nicest person. And I remember thinking, hope so.
Yeah.
But I met with this teacher, and I was telling her that we're approaching, you know, 12, 13. And she said, if you look at life like not my child, you can pretty well be sure it's going to be your child. Or it is your child. Or maybe your child's the ringleader.
Right.
So you have to be able to look at all possible sides. It could be my child. It could be my child sneaking a cigarette, or lying to my face, or talking behind my back, or causing trouble, or mistreating somebody at school. It very well could be. If I deny it, I'm setting myself up for huge trouble.
That's so true. And so what happened when he started on painkillers from the injury, and then how did it unfold that it really turned into an addiction? What did that look like for you guys?
Well, I had a lot of trust with him because we had really good communication. But one of the things I noticed, there's repetitive behavior that comes along with a dependency, a dysfunctional dependency. And that is, for me, what was different was the level of conflict we started having. We really didn't have issues we couldn't resolve by the end of the night and just discuss through and end up laughing about, or whatever the case may be, moving forward. But when that became perpetual and consistent, when you're in the presence of conflict that's not resolvable anyway, something's wrong. You're in the presence of dysfunction or a problem, a dependency, I don't know. But when that's consistently going on and there's never really a time of peace, that's a bad sign. And then just catching lies, and I was all over his technology and social media, and I found things there as well. Mm-hmm. So I would call a police officer I knew that worked out in the community, and then I also would go talk to a pharmacist at the pharmacy down the street and say, what are these terms? What are these things I'm seeing and finding, when it developed into not just prescribed use, but he was purchasing it and people were bringing it illegally. That I just stayed on top of it, and that's how I started finding out things.
And so what kinds of words and things were you seeing, just so people can be really aware of what to look for?
One of the things was, I saw a kid had sent him a message in social media that said, we are getting together and going roller skating tonight. And I knew that wasn't something any of them were into anymore. And my son had declined to go, thank goodness. But I just remember thinking, that feels like a code to me.
Okay.
And that's another thing. If you have a gut feeling, believe it. So I called this police officer and he said anything to do with roller skating or rolling or anything like that is a term of ecstasy or can relate to something like that.
Really?
So that was something he didn't necessarily involve himself in at that time, but that was one of those words that I was like, just something feels off about right. this message. And because I was crazy, once I found out what it meant, I contacted that kid and his parents and I did background checks on all of them and sent messages. And this is your son's message to my son and what he's involved in, what he's interested in. I would just go running with things like that because it was, I believe, I was at war against my son's potential death. So I took it serious, like life and death.
Absolutely. And so what was their response when you started reaching out to these parents?
I wasn't received well. I call that, in the book, I call that friendly fire. And I don't know if it's because this was a few years back, so people weren't as openly discussing like they are now since it's such an epidemic. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't well received. I'd had one father say, well, what are we supposed to do about it? Boys will be boys. And I said, but I think your son's, consuming prescription pills that are very addictive and, can lead to overdose. So it's not boys will be boys sneaking a beer behind the bleachers at a football game. This is full-blown addiction. But yeah. It was just not received. And then I'd had another father say, no, our son only spends time with your son to be a good influence because you're a single parent household. Our son's in a double parent household. There's two parents in the home. So if he's around your son at all, it's only to be involved as an influence. He would never do any of this. And I hate to even say this part of it, but that his son ended up in treatment within a year. Mm-hmm. And I believe still struggles. I don't know, but you just have to really be careful how you stick your head in the sand and deny. And also be careful how you treat people because you never know if the same problems that you're kind of scorning them for will darken your door.
It might be our first reaction to be defensive and to be like, not my child, no way, it's you, it's because of your situation. That might be our first initial reaction, but I think it's really important to hear stories like yours to prepare yourself so maybe you can avoid that initial first reaction that is not really appropriate. And you are coming from a place of not shaming them, like my son is the good one and your son's the bad
right.
one. You're trying to unify all these parents who just want to save their kids.
Right. You and know? I wasn't making, I wasn't putting things online saying, hey, everybody, this is my problem. Woe is me. I never put anything out for the world to see. I privately, with discretion, and once I had evidence, only when I had evidence, contacted a handful of parents. I would research everybody, but I would contact the ones that I thought should know. That I knew from Little League or private school, or a lot of them were from church. And I would always say, my motive, because I believe in being transparent, is to make you aware, because I don't know if you're aware and you don't care, or you're not aware. But if I found this situation out and I found out anybody had knowledge, I would be knocking on your door to find out why you didn't call me. So do with it what you please. I'm moving on. I won't contact you. I don't need to sit and hash it out over coffee.
Right.
Or in the bleachers with you. I'm just making you aware. This is what I found. And at the time, none of them even asked to see how I knew. So I just had to shake it off. At first, it was kind of devastating because I'd known them all for years and I felt like they shamed me. And that's a frustrating feeling. But then I just learned to just be irritated and keep on moving.
Right. And heaven forbid something bad did happen to one of them and you did have that knowledge.
Exactly.
I mean, you couldn't have lived with yourself. Like, that would have been real.
Right.
That burden would have been too much.
At
even worse
I did
in the confrontation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So an interesting part of your story is that your mom became very protective and almost enabling of him. Now, because you had mentioned that she dealt with some addiction type things in the past, do you think that had a correlation of why maybe she was more supportive of your son during this time?
Well, I never really could figure out, and we've all analyzed it to a degree, and I've had conversations with her about it. I can never really figure out what the motive was, whether it was a disdain for me, whether it was where she was in life, whether it her dependency contributed. I never really could figure out what it was. I just know that I had conflict with her constantly about him, and then when it became from childhood stuff to the addiction issues, I started realizing I have to see her as an enemy to a good outcome because she's hindering what I'm trying to do, which is keep him safe, expose it, create consequences, be kind of rails to cause him to decide out of this. And she was kind of postponing it and making it last longer. And I had asked my mother to please not give my son her car. Don't loan it to him. I want him to have nothing except a phone to call me and say, come get me. I want out of this. I don't know if she really believed she was helping or protecting him from consequences, which is what most enablers are doing. Yeah. And I really can't figure out the motive. I just know it was misery.
Right. It doesn't make
strange
sense.
Strange misery.
It doesn't make rational sense, but there was something underneath that was driving that. And yeah, I'm sure you've analyzed this to death and whatnot, but how frustrating to have that person, especially somebody in your inner circle that you would have liked to rely upon or trust, inhibiting your ability to just get your son the help that he needed.
Right, or make him decide to get it. And I really felt like, I mean, there was a lot of dynamics to it because I was kind of grieving where the direction he was heading in and remembering, you know, this kid I had rocked to sleep and taught to read and carefully chosen schools for and, you know, loved him carefully. And then I was grieving also, I don't have a mom to call. Like, I don't have parents. Not only has my dad passed away, I don't have a mom to call. Not only do I not have a mom to call, she's presenting as my enemy, as an enemy, which is hard to deal with anyway, but an enemy for my son's safety.
Wow.
So it was a nightmare I couldn't explain, but just right on time, which is how life works when you're kind of trying to do the right thing and be on track, three women appeared in my life who were in the field of therapy, and they just led me right through out of the darkness. And what I would think would be a crazy argument with my mother or in the situation, they would recognize as dependency and substance-related issues and addict behavior and enabling behavior. So that began to illuminate the path forward, so I knew how to no access boundary her and consequence him.
Right. So you couldn't necessarily choose or change the circumstances, but just having awareness about how to label things and how to view things really helped you be able to move on.
Right, and helped me know how to handle me because I can only handle me. And one of them had said to me, I would call her and just rip my hair out and say, my mom again. And she'd say, well, what's different this time? Nothing.
Right.
Well, then why would you expect she's doing
this
what she
again?
Does? She's not doing anything different. She's being her. Your expectations are what's sick and off. So then I would say, okay, I have to expect her to do her. All I can do is handle me.
And so as you went through this journey and as he would, you know, drop weight and then he would kind of come back and be a little repentant, but then it would slide back. So there was just constantly this pendulum, right? Going back and forth. How did you move on during that time? Were you constantly in high alert that entire time? Or did you kind of just have to, I don't know, just kind of step back and let him choose? How did you handle that?
Well, there's a lot of layers of dynamics to it. You are crazy. It makes you absolutely crazy because you are terrorized with fear and pain and, you know, shame to a degree, but that wasn't even important enough to trump the fear that I tormented myself with. I would wake up and imagine him in prison or in a casket, and I carried around a post-it note where I drew a casket with his date of birth, and I would keep changing and forwarding his death date so I would remember, if I make this easy for him, this is the outcome. It just made me absolutely crazy, but I had enough presence of mind that I didn't take that out on people around me, and I tried to keep it from, you know, anyone else's kids that were in my life, or I tried not to take it into work. I confided it in one girl there who had kids, and we'd gotten pretty close, and I finally said, I've got this issue going on with my son, so that she wouldn't just think I was in a horrible mood toward her, because sometimes I would shut the door of my office and turn my back to everybody, and just, like, I had learned to kind of bawl my eyes out and then pick myself back up and face clients and go about my day while this monster's in my heart.
Right.
So I was crazy.
Yeah.
It makes you crazy, but you have to still function.
Right.
But it absolutely terrorizes you.
Would you have let more people in looking back now? Do you wish you had kind of opened up to more people about this to let them know what was going on with you? Or would you do things the same way?
I wish I would have probably joined a support group earlier. Mm-hmm. But I think you have to be careful opening up because well-intending people can say things that are absolutely wounding. You know, you might have somebody say, well, just cut him off forever. And you can't hear that in certain moments. Or I had one person say to me, and she was even educated about addiction, this is looking so bad, there's no way he's going to avoid prison. And I just felt like my heart deflate. And I would think, well, I guess, you know, we're just trash. We just deserve it. And that's just our outcome. Yeah. But then I would kind of bolster myself and think, absolutely not. I'm going to take the reins of this. Not only am I going to do everything I can, I'm going to pull my faith into it and pray until I have no energy left that the outcome is good. And then I'm going to believe for it. I'm going to do everything I can to believe for it and do my part that this outcome will be good. So yeah. I do kind of regret that I didn't have a support system, which is why one of the reasons I wrote the book, because not everybody will go to a meeting or have a therapist friend. But I had a really good safe circle where I could call them and say, this is my day. And they would be caught up on the dynamics of it already. So I guess that's yes and no.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you don't want to feel like you have to be isolated by this. And you definitely want to know you're not alone in this. Because I'm sure there were definitely days where you felt like, I'm the only one going through this. I'm a terrible mom. I caused this. Like those thoughts
we
come
in. We deserve
this. Exactly. But to hear other stories from other good, well-meaning moms who've had similar experiences, that's got to be validating in a way. But then by the same token, the more that you let people in, the more their opinions and their comments can affect you for good
so
or for bad.
They can't possibly understand unless they're either educated or have experienced it.
It's a very unique thing.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I began talking with families at a treatment center over the past year, and I've heard so many of these similar stories, as well as I've attended a support group where you're kind of able to let your guard down, and hearing people having some of the same problems, the dynamics all change, and not everybody has the mother situation like I had, where she's kind of the church lady and addicted and dangerous enabler. That's pretty tough to beat. Right. So I always say that's kind of the area that I can hands down one-up anybody. But other than that dynamic, they're almost all the exact same situations and scenarios or familiar problems, and the feelings of pain and terror are certainly the same. So that was helpful to connect on those levels and to hear those things where it's like, okay, it's not because I deserved it or what right. I come from or that I mishandled anything. It's pretty common to the dysfunction of prescribed addiction that we didn't certainly deserve or ask for.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think addicts in this day and age look a lot different than the stereotype you might have thought 20 years ago. It's not the dirty people in the back alleys. It's not, you know, like you've said, like the trash people. Like, no, it's not. A lot of times it's the entitled, well-off children that have access to these things. It might come from an injury. It might come from just convenience. You don't know. But just because you're in a well-to-do neighborhood and you've set your kids up for success does not make you immune to this type of challenge. And I think it's an important message to get out. I've seen this in my own community as well. Both deaths coming right. from this and brain damage and severe handicaps caused by very, very small starts post-injuries, like things that their situation started with such a seemingly benign prescription to heal, and it turns into a near death or a death in some situations. And it's
or just
tragic.
The family, it changes the entire trajectory of the family. The whole family's turned upside down. And one thing I've learned is it's easier for somebody who comes from trauma or poverty or whatever to find help because they're not as worried about keeping up appearances.
Wow,
it's
yeah.
harder for somebody that comes from privilege or being coddled. They don't have the same survival skills and they present a lot differently. So they're not going to reach out and say, hey, we've got this problem in our son or in our family. It takes a lot longer for that to come forward. And by then, it's a problem that snowballs so fast and so bad, you can't contain it for the sake of appearance. Eventually, that can't matter anymore. But in the more well-to-do communities, there's a tougher time getting free of it because of the appearance.
Absolutely. And like you said, those parents that were in denial and maybe they knew about it or had signs and didn't want to deal with it, or maybe they had no clue, who knows? But either way, you know, it does have a lot to do with appearances, and having your appearances stifle your ability to help keep your child alive, I don't know, not worth it. And that's what you found.
Not worth it. Right.
So what was the turning?
Because I was never really into appearance, that never was really, I didn't care.
Yeah.
After a while, I didn't care. I mean, I've always been private and a loner by virtue of what I come from, but I really didn't ever in my life care to present a reality that doesn't exist. I've just really never been that person.
Yeah. So what was the turning point for your son in getting the help that he needed?
Well, we went through, it was a learning curve, so we went through trial and error and ups and downs, and, you know, they become very manipulative and getting by or presenting that they are sober and doing well when they're not. And the more intelligent I was or got about it, the more intelligent he got about hiding it. Yeah. So, we, you know, back and forth and up and down and here and there. And then finally, he says himself, my mom gave me the best two gifts possible, and that was misery and desperation. Mm. And I kind of insisted everyone has to turn their back on him until he calls me. I'm not saying you're cut off from me for life. I'm saying I will do nothing but help you get to treatment. So call me for that, and I will drop what I'm doing and race to you. But nobody's to give you money or to give you a place to stay or help you in any way because you're going to die like this. Mm. So he had ended up sleeping in a dugout where he played Little League and travel ball, and it was excruciating. And sometimes I would go and watch with binoculars, and then sometimes I couldn't seem to see it. So I intentionally went out of town that weekend and said, figure it out. Call me or figure it out. And he got fed up. He wasn't going to do that for long because he was raised to a degree in comfort. And he booked a flight to California, took off, and has been doing it on his own ever since. And that was about 3.5 years ago.
So do you think that's the key, having them be the one that's motivated? Because if it's put on them, you know, and they don't really have skin in the game, they're like, well, I'm just doing this for mom, the relapse is more common. Is that what you've seen?
Right, yes. Well, he had gone one time before that, and mm-hmm. he went because of consequences, and he went begrudgingly. So he was bitter and angry and hateful all the way there. And then it stuck for a little bit, and he relapsed the day he got out. So then we just went round and round and round. And then he would, you know, try to get it together and play it off or whatever the case may be. But when he had been, you know, become desperate and miserable, and I would always tell him, this pit that you're in, I'm not going to climb into it with you and decorate it. I'm not going to make it comfortable. I'm not going to drop McDonald's into it. But when you want out, I will be that ladder and help you find your way forward. So absolutely, I wanted it to be miserable. I would pray misery on him, make him hate this life as much as I hate it for him. Because if he hates it, he's going to get sick of it and want out of it. If it's, if he has to go through withdrawal, if he has to go lack, if he has to be embarrassed or hungry and hates it, he's not going to want this life. Mm-hmm. So I would tell everybody, don't comfort him in it. Leave everything to me, and I will offer him treatment. So, I mean, it took a while, but finally that's the point he got to because he had nowhere else to turn, and then he was kind of like, I hate this. Right. I hate this life. And that's when they find their way out.
And it took years. And I think for parents that may be fearing that, you know, this might be in their future or maybe they're dealing with it right now, they want a quick fix. They want it to be tomorrow. They want their child to be better soon. And regardless of what situation they're going through, maybe it's a hard toddler phase. Maybe it's, you know, a driving problem. Maybe it's addiction. Whatever it might look like in your life, you want that hurt and that suffering to be over fast. But ultimately, it might take a little longer. And so you have to do whatever it is to keep yourself strong throughout that and just stick to your guns and stick with it. Because if you stick with it, there is hope. There's always hope. Wouldn't you say?
Right, there is. And that anxiety part of it is that kind of hindered me as well. I always said I knew what to do for the terrible twos, but when it came to the terrible 22s and the consequences and stakes are higher, you know, there is an excruciating need to speed things up. And so I kind of like to joke and say, like, every mom, I have a weight problem, the WAIT problem. I want this solved now, particularly with such a terrifying issue. Mm-hmm. So I would try to, the opposite end of the spectrum was my mom enabled him, and I tried to force consequences constantly. And to a point, nothing anyone else does works. They have to decide it. Mm-hmm. So actually, when he had gotten to California, he had a relapse. And I remember thinking, what? I thought we were at the finish line. I thought this was over and we were going to have this great life now. And things were going to be normal and holidays and vacations and addiction's going to be out of our vocabulary. And then I kind of had myself, I don't know if it was arrogant or foolish, thinking, oh, well, I was this like Aaron Brockovich of consequences. I was the non-enabling role model. And I handled everything with such smart, wisdom, tough love that look at where he's at now. And then he relapsed. And I remember thinking, how is that even possible? I did all the right things. Mm-hmm. But, and then other people will say, well, get him out of state, get him away from their friends and their locations and all of that. None of that really proved to be true because there's a quote that says, wherever you go, there you are. And whether they are sent to the middle of the desert, if they are determined to find that substance, they're going to find it. whether I do everything right or everything wrong, everything eventually comes back to that person's decisions and accountability. Right. That was a huge lesson for me to learn.
Wow. Yeah, and that's true in any life stage for any child anywhere, and for ourselves,
right.
And for ourselves as well.
Right.
Wow. So what does his life look like today? You've said he's been sober for several years. What does his life look like now?
Well, he's really hardworking, and he's enjoying his life. He has a girlfriend, and they like to travel, and he loves California, and he's doing his own thing, and I intentionally don't pay attention to his sobriety date or how well he's doing because I was so dependent on his safety, and I was so consumed with him that I finally stepped back and thought, I've got to work on my recovery. I don't want to, you know, relapse with him to where I'm investigating. And, you know, I could imagine myself driving across the country and not separate from that person when you're obsessing over how well is he doing.
I
would find myself triaging even his problems in recovery. And then it's like, I have to separate. And even if he's sober, if I'm obsessing over how well he is sober, that's not peace or sanity for me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is that's amazing. I like how you said, like, you have to focus on recovery for you. It's not,
right.
Yeah, that was a lot for you to go through as well. Because it's,
right.
Yeah, it's not just the addict. It's everyone involved in that story. So what made you want to write this book, Unhooked, which is just amazing and vulnerable, and it really gets you inside of a situation like this that you may not have, you know, ever really known the ins and outs of before, like I hadn't.
Right. Well, I felt like I've said it's, I felt this gravitational pull to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to give examples to not shame anybody, but to definitely say there is, you know, there is some dishonor in this embarrassment to dysfunction. And there is some frustrating, unfair things that should have or could have been handled different. But there's triumph at the end of every situation. And forgiveness is absolutely crucial. It is as a mom anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time your child turns on you and throws a tantrum or breaks something on purpose when they're just little, you have to daily forgive these kids that get on your nerves or maybe manipulate you or don't respond at the grocery store the right way. That's lifelong, and that's every day a lesson in forgiveness. So I wrote this book to just for all sides of that, to basically show that we found our way forward, that in this epidemic where you don't hear a lot of success stories, particularly a codependent, crazed mom finding recovery, we're a success story. You can find your way back to peace and sanity after all of that. And plus, because I was constantly in the library and picking people's brains to try to find information, and the majority of literature I found was written for or by the person addicted.
Mm.
Whether it was I was homeless and lived on the train tracks, and now I have a family life and a wife and kids, and I'm sober, and I'm a speaker, and I'm a millionaire, or I'm a, you know, an executive or whatever, a pastor, whatever. I didn't hear from somebody who was raised with dysfunction because they're the daughter of an addict.
Mm.
Or where was the mom walking the floors when that addict was homeless? Where's her recovery story? Where's her time? What did she do? What was she thinking and feeling? How did she handle it, right or wrong? And that's absolutely what I needed. So I wanted to completely be transparent and open myself up and say, this is my background, came out of it. This
right.
is what we went through. This is what I did horribly wrong. This is what I felt like when I would, you know, break down on my knees on the floor at night, not knowing when I was going to hear from him again. And this is where we're at now. And
wow.
It's a success story.
It is. It is. Go, Annie. Go, Annie. Look at you go. I think you're exactly right. I think having your perspective versus just the firsthand perspective of the addict is such a valuable one. And I know that it will be so helpful for moms in your shoes, and definitely insightful for even moms like me that are not in your shoes, but just definitely want that awareness, because I have three little boys right now. You know, this could be any
right.
one of them, and being naive
or
to
their friends.
Yeah, or their friends. And so being naive does not make you immune to that. So that's not helpful. So I don't want to be that
right.
mom. I don't want to be that mom. How would you say this has changed you as a mom overall? How have you evolved since the beginning of this to where you are now?
It forced me not to be obsessed.
Mm.
And I guess I knew I was to a degree, but then when the when crisis and adversity hits, everything that is resident within you kind of foams up to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as I realize I am obsessed, you kind of justify it with I have to be, because not only did I come from dysfunction, but now we're facing actual life and death crisis. So when things kind of calmed down and he pursued his adult life, I had to realize, okay, deal with me, handle me. That it completely transformed how I view my role in his life.
Yeah, and I think that's so important. Wow, Annie, you are so amazing, and I just want to thank you for sharing this journey. It's incredibly personal and vulnerable, but I know that by sharing, you're going to help a lot of people and just increase their awareness and their perspective about this type of challenge.
Well, thanks so much. I hope so.
Yeah. Well, I always ask my guests one final question, and it's this. What would you tell your pre-motherhood self?
I would tell her, you're going to make it. It's all going to be okay. You're going to pull through, and nobody has this all pulled together. You absolutely matter, and don't ever give up.
I love that. And you didn't. And look at you now, and look at him. You must be so proud.
Thanks so much.
That's amazing.
I'm relieved to say
that. I bet. Well, on my website, extraordinarymomspodcast.com, I'll link to your book, Unhooked, by Annie Highwater. And then I know that you really love to highlight these resources that really helped your son to get the help that he needed. Do you want to share what those are? And I'll link to those as well.
Sure, absolutely. There is a website online, and you can find support groups as well, as much as daily postings and encouragement and people openly sharing their experiences, called the Addicts Parents United. That's on Facebook. There's a closed group that's private as well as a public one. And then the treatment center he ended up in and ended up working for that was life-saving is SOBA. That's spelled S-O-B-A. The CEO and founder, his name is actually Greg Hanley. He walked me through the process like a family member. And every time I would call him pulling my hair out, like I'm catching these behaviors, or what do I do? And before I was at a point where I took my hands off, he would take those calls patiently and he'd say, you're coming out of post-traumatic stress, and you go take care of you. Go get a manicure. Go take care of you. I'll take care of him. So he believes in long-term treatment. It's not 14 to 28 days, and you're back into your family, and we got to figure this out now after we've been traumatized and to the craziest aspects of life. They believe in long-term care and dealing with the person who's addicted and moving them not just out of addiction, but back into life and what their original goals were, or some new ones. So my son began to pursue his dreams, and that's what he's doing out there now. I can't say enough about what SOBA did to save our life. And I'd like to say their number if that's possible.
Absolutely.
You can call them if you or someone you know is struggling with a long-term opiate addiction, and they, with kindness, will try to help you as much as possible and receive you as a family. They believe in working with the whole family, not just the person addicted. And their number is 866-547-6455. Greg wrote the foreword for my book, and again, I can't say enough about either of these groups. They are tremendously kind, understanding, and helpful for families.
And that's exactly what you need when you're facing this type of challenge.
Absolutely. Support is everything. Information, education, and support are everything.
Wow. Well, thank you, Annie. Thank you for chatting with me today. Thank you for sharing your story. I know that it's going to be really impactful and insightful to the listeners today, so I hope you have the best day.
Perfect. Thank you so much, and I will look forward to listening.
Thank you. I want to thank Annie for being so vulnerable and sharing her story. It is a story and a journey unlike anything we've had on the podcast so far, and I hope that it was not only interesting to you, but also shared with you that nothing's outside the realm of possibility in your future. And when you think, oh, that could never happen to me, that's when you might be blindsided by something. And so it's important to understand that these issues are real and they exist. And we need to have compassion for other people that are going through this, as well as be aware that it might hit our own family as well. So all the resources that we talked about, her book, the resources to the recovery center that she mentioned, SOBA, that will all be on the show notes page at extraordinarymomspodcast.com. As always, you can follow me on Instagram at JessicaDahlquist3 and on Facebook at Extraordinary Moms Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning into the podcast today. It's so fun bringing you these episodes every week, and I just thank you for tuning in. So we'll see you next week for another episode with another Extraordinary Mom. Bye.